From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Buffalo when a director and a producer decided to talk to a group of white Americans, 21 of them. They spoke openly about their experience of being white in America. What does it mean? Are there advantages? Some said, absolutely. One man said he believes that in 2014, it's white people who are persecuted the most. Well, that's just the start of what became Whiteness Project, Inside the White Caucasian Box. It's an interactive and multimedia documentary available through PBS.org now, and the project is sparking a broader conversation about what white means as an ethnicity, what is white privilege, and more. The director and the producer is Whitney Dow, and he joins us now. Whitney, first of all, thank you for taking the time. Welcome to Connections.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
And in studio, we welcome Ann Johnson, the director of ACT Rochester. And Ann is not only going to be sharing some of her thoughts, but also running down the various initiatives that we've seen. It's been a busy couple of years, Ann.
It certainly has, and thank you for having me on today.
All right, well, great to have you. Whitney, let me start by getting to the genesis of this project. And I heard you on with my colleague Beth Adams this morning. Turns out it was, as I understand it, a question from a young girl that sparked your idea for the Whiteness Project?
Yeah, I've been doing projects with my black producing partner, Marco Williams, for a number of years. And I, even though we had sort of been doing a lot, and all our stuff was really on race, but we were giving a talk one time, and a young seventh grade girl asked me what I learned most about my racial, my racial identity working with Marco. And I really didn't have an answer for her. I should say the answer I wanted to give her was, I don't have one. I'm Whitney Dow. And at the same time, I sort of came to the realization that despite all the work I had done in this arena, that I really hadn't accepted that my racial identity as a white male was sort of, that I had the most powerful racial identity in the country, and that it really impacted every moment of every day of my life.
And here we've already seen on Twitter, for example, other social media, the moment you put a project out there called the Whiteness Project, you had a lot of negative reaction very quickly before people knew what it was all about. Was that frustrating for you?
Yes and no. I mean, look, you know, without like inspiring more Twitter rage, you don't go to Twitter for like deep contemplation of ideas. And I think that I absolutely recognize that that the project's provocative in its very construct. And so, but I think that what I saw happen is that the first few days, people would go to the website, take a screenshot, put it up on Twitter, and say, you know, this makes me want to vomit, you know, or something like that. And so it generated a lot of traffic. But as time went on, what I saw by looking at the analytics is that people were spending longer and longer and longer on the site, and the stuff that was getting written was much more considered. And I think that was really for two reasons. One, the fact that, you know, POV was involved and PBS made them realize they had to sort of take a look at it and see what it is. And also, I without tooting my own horn, I have a track record of working on this stuff for a long time in a lot of different ways, and I'm not just somebody who just came to this idea yesterday. It's really the result of 18 years of work that I've been doing, working on race projects with my partner, Marco Williams.
And Whitney, I hope I had it right when I said 21 people from the Buffalo area?
That's correct. We actually shot more than that, but these were the people that I felt were both, some people I didn't use, so I didn't feel that it would be fair to use them. They weren't, you know, I didn't feel like they represented them accurately. I want to be very, very careful about how I represent people. I want them to be representational of what I think the experience I had with them. And I also wanted them to be representational of larger issues and ideas that I've been confronted with during my previous work.
Okay, and so before I go any further, let's play a clip here. And again, 21 people speaking more at length here. This is just kind of a cross section, but I wanted to give our listening audience a chance to hear some of the voices that you will encounter when you go check out the Whiteness Project online. Let's listen.
I don't feel that personally I have benefited from being white. Again, just because I grew up relatively poor.
I live with an African American. We do the same things. We live the same life. But I guess inherently there's never going to be a time where a person with lighter skin completely understands what a person with darker skin might go through on a daily basis.
I'm living a pretty good life. I can't say it's because I'm white, but I'm sure if I'd been born into a minority, things could have been a lot rougher.
It's my honest opinion that today the white race is the one that's discriminated against anymore.
Should slavery be something that, because it happened, we owe black people something more? Absolutely not.
All right, so there's a cross-section. And I think, Whitney, that shows us that this isn't just a group of white people denying white privilege or a group of white people talking that white privilege is real. It's a real cross-section.
Well, thank you for playing that much of a cross-section, because most people who I've been talking to have led with that last quote or one of the other quotes that are like that. And look, the fact that people are grappling with the idea of recognizing that we have a complicated and not so glorious past as Americans when it comes to race, and grappling whether we owe the people, black people, something, is one thing. But I think that we're all grappling with this idea of race, and I think what's interesting is that when you ask people about whiteness, they talk about black people. And I think that's because our sense of our own whiteness is very caught up with our relationship to black people.
What an interesting comment, and I'd never even thought of it that way, but that's what the Whiteness Project is making us think about. And if you want to join the program, let me let our listeners know. We'd like to hear your experiences. If you want to kind of share your own hour-long comments on not just the Whiteness Project, your thought perhaps on white privilege, those kind of a thing. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Whitney, I think it's easy for some people to fixate on some of the comments there and not the whole. But at the same time, I understand why certain comments stick out. When the person said, I think the white race is the one that is discriminated against most, or I don't think I benefited from being white because I grew up poor, that's, to me, that's a little myopic. But at the same time, that's hardly an outlier in terms, I'm not saying that's the majority population, but what do you think when you hear those remarks?
Well, you're exactly right. It isn't an outlier, but I also think that, especially in places like Buffalo, where there's a lot of blue collar population, or the big blue collar population, and, some real issues with employment in the economy, and also the sense that the demographics of this country are rapidly changing, and that our place as white people in this country is being sort of redefined because of that, that there's this real sense of anxiety. And I think it's very easy to take the negative things that you're experiencing them, and that's how you want to judge the context in which you live in. I think sometimes it's harder to look at when you're trying to survive, look at the reality of the larger context that, without question, white people enjoy disproportionate benefits of American society than people who aren't white. That's just a reality if you look at the numbers. But that doesn't necessarily dictate someone's personal narrative and personal experience, and sometimes it's hard to get beyond that, especially if you're struggling.
Well, and that's why I think I would love for our listeners to check out the Whiteness Project in its entirety. I think it's moving and it's interesting, and when you hear it at length, it is not sensationalistic. And Whitney, I get the sense that you may not personally agree with some of those comments there, but you've also, as a director and producer, been very careful to try to guard against possible backlash against those people for participating.
Absolutely. I feel that, my stock line is like, don't come after those people, come after me. If you have a problem with what they say, I think that they were very brave to come forward and speak honestly. And I think that we always hear over and over in the media, we want to have an honest conversation about race. We want to have an honest conversation about race. But then when people speak honestly, people freak out. And I think that in order to bring white people in as fully vested partners in changing the racial dynamic, you're going to have to let them talk honestly, even if they say things you don't like. And if you just shout them down right away, that's not gonna bring anybody to the table.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. And just to show you that it's not, just show our listening audience that these are not outliers, if those are not the kind of comments you hear often. There was there was a debate that went pretty viral, as The Daily Show sometimes does. It was about a month ago that Jon Stewart welcomed Bill O'Reilly, and they ended up spending the entire conversation on whether white privilege exists. Bill O'Reilly from Fox News saying that it no longer does. Let's listen to a section from that. You're going to hear Bill O'Reilly and Jon Stewart from The Daily Show.
That was then. This is now.
Oh, it's right? No. What, there was white privilege, yeah,
maybe,
but it no longer exists.
Maybe you haven't figured out that there is no more slavery, no more Jim Crow. Ooh. All right.
All right.
And
all right.
The most powerful man in the world.
All right. Oh boy.
Is
here we go.
A black American.
Oh.
But
oh,
you
boy.
Don't put forth. Mm-hmm. All right. This white privilege, and if you fail, that's why you fail. All right, America is now a place where if you work hard, get educated, and an honest person, you can succeed. That's what should be put out there.
Oh,
let me repeat this, and I'll do it slowly.
All right.
So even you can understand.
All right, all right.
If you work hard, if you get educated, if you're an honest person, you can make it in America.
That's Bill O'Reilly with Jon Stewart. And Whitney, I don't know if you had seen that interview, but again, some of Bill O'Reilly's comments are kind of represented in different ways by the comments we see in the Whiteness Project.
Well, I think it's very, look, I did watch it, and it was great to see that. And I was lucky enough to launch this project in the same week that interview came out, which I don't think hurt people coming to it and taking a look at it. Look, when it stops raining, it's not instantly dry, right? I mean, that's just the reality. It may not be raining now, but it's still wet, or I think that the easiest way I sort of like to explain white privilege to people is if you're playing poker with someone and they're cheating for hours, they build up a huge stack of money and then you catch them and they say, "You're right, I'm wrong. I was cheating. I won't cheat anymore. Let's play fairly now, but you better not cheat. And I'm not giving up any of this cash." It takes a while for once things stop, for things to for the structure to change. And I think that's what's so hard for white people sometimes to represent. Yes, it's not me now, maybe, but there were 400 years of creating this infrastructure, and it's not going to change overnight.
Well, and this is why the Whiteness Project, I think, is so valuable. When you have people, everyday Americans from Buffalo, New York, speaking very similarly to what you just heard from Bill O'Reilly and some others, it's easy, as you say, Whitney, to shout them down. When you hear them at length and you realize they're not coming from a place of malice, they're coming from their honest perspective, that helps us understand different points of view and decide how we want to engage, as opposed to just throwing bombs on both sides, which ends up convincing nobody to change their mind.
Exactly. You put it very well. I think that the other thing that's been really interesting about this project that has been really gratifying and actually taught me something about engaging this an idea like this is that because of this, for whatever reason I did, because of the structure of it, traditionally when people talk about race, it's sort of a mediator facilitated experience by sort of some expert. This project has been shared over Facebook somewhere between 30 and 40,000 times at this point. So let's say there's 100 people in a network. I don't know. Is there, or 10 people in a network? That's 300,000 people who are now taken to their private space and facilitating discussion about this themselves with people they trust and care about, as opposed to a traditional facilitated experience where you go and do a screening and then there's some sort of expert who tries to educate you. And I think that people have to grapple with this in their own way to sort of understand their experience better.
I also want to play one more comment from an interview we did about a month ago with Pastor Marlo Washington, who was on this program talking about a number of different things. But what he told me was one of the main differences that maybe the average white person might not always understand is that Marlo and I are, we're not exactly the same age. We're not that far off. But when people meet me, they assume that I'm a smart person until I would show them otherwise. When they meet Marlo Washington, who's a black pastor in Rochester, more often than not, his experience is they assume he's not intelligent until he proves otherwise. That assumption came up when he was having a conversation with someone else, and here's how he described it on this program. Let's listen to Pastor Washington.
Just last Friday, had a discussion with this individual, sharing with me that, Marlo, yeah, I'm a white guy that lives in the suburb of Rochester. And there are, in the back of my mind, there are some prejudice inside of me. But that's because of the imagery that sometimes, you know, the press portrays. We in the black community might portray. The whites portray. So in the back of all of our mind, there's always the imagery of what we might think you are until you speak. And then when you speak, you got sense. You got sense, you know, and then you got to go to the next spiel to say, I'm sorry for thinking that way. You know, so there's this prejudice that I think lies in all of us that we've got to begin to honestly confront.
That's Pastor Marlo Washington. What do you think, Whitney?
I think he's exactly right. It's really interesting. I can sort of tell a corollary story that, you know, when Marco and I are working, many times Marco, who if you talk to him on the phone, he sounds just like I do. We went to the same schools, and he actually lived in my house for a while. And he'll set up a meeting, and then we'll walk into the meeting, and the person who's had the meeting, if it's a white, will walk right over to me and say, oh, Marco, nice to meet you. They'll assume that I'm Marco because after interacting with him, of course, that the white guy in the pair is going to be is Marco. And it always, you know, on some level we laugh about it, but it's also it's a re-education every time it happens. And I think that's absolutely right, that we are bombarded with these issues. But I think also, you know, look, I think it's not just external. I think human beings are ultimately clannish, and we're ultimately like to be around people that remind us of ourselves. And I think that it's not that you can eradicate prejudice within yourself. I think it's more that, you know, that you start to learn to understand it and how it impacts your interaction with the world. And I think that's one of the most discomforting things about these videos, is that I think anybody, even, you know, informed, liberal, righteous people look at those videos, and if they're honest with themselves, they hold pieces of some of the most discomforting things in the video somewhere inside them, and that's hard to reconcile sometimes.
And before we broaden the conversation with Ann Johnson about some of the other initiatives that have been taking place as well, let's get to the phones, because I know people have been waiting to weigh in. This is Mike in Brighton. Mike, thanks for calling Connections.
Yeah, hi. I guess I just wanted to comment, especially after hearing Bill O'Reilly's interview there with John Stewart. You know, it's almost laughable that he wants to deny the sense of institutional racism that exists. And to deny white privilege is kind of just absurd. It's like, where is he living if he thinks that just because we have a African-American president, that means that the whole rest of society has all of a sudden cleansed itself of its racism, even among people like myself, who, like you just said, someone who's a progressive, who believes in equality, etc. You can't deny what's in our society that is ingrained, and it's going to take, you know, we like you said earlier, you played poker and you cheated for all these years, but you're not starting now. You're not starting at the same place. And so there still needs to be a lot of work to make it so that the opportunity that does exist is truly there for all who want to take advantage of those opportunities.
Mike, thanks for the call. And let me start with Whitney. What do you think, Whitney?
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, remember that Bill O'Reilly's comments come from a man who grew up in Levittown, where black people weren't allowed to buy houses. So, you know, the basis of his success was built on institutionalized racism. But I agree with the caller 100%. You know, I think that it is gonna take a while, for us to restructure, you know, for the structures to change. But I also really think that people always talk about changing the structure, but structures and institutions are made with people. And I'm not an activist, I'm a filmmaker, and film is an emotional medium, not an informational medium. And I sort of came to the point of, I had an experience that changed me personally, and hopefully I can create something that will change people personally, and then they will go on to change the institutions they're involved in.
What do you think, Ann, when you hear about what Mike's talking about there?
Well, I do think it's important that we look at individual racism and then interpersonal, which is where you're able to take it into a larger organization and maybe have an impact on the institutional instructional racism. It's at all different levels, and there are different ways to approach moving the needle in the right direction.
But let me ask Ann and Whitney sort of a follow-up on Mike's point, and looking at what Bill O'Reilly said. Bill O'Reilly made the point that we don't have slavery or Jim Crow anymore, that the world has changed and that anyone's got an opportunity to succeed. I think we're at a more difficult point because what Bill O'Reilly's talking about is obvious. Slavery is obviously abhorrent. Jim Crow is obviously abhorrent. And when you remove the low-hanging fruit, the obvious things that are wrong, and we've talked about on this program before, the white and black bathrooms, the sitting on the front of the bus versus the back of the bus, those are the obvious things that are either ridiculous or horrible or abhorrent. And it becomes easier once those things are out of the way to convince yourself that there's nothing wrong, that everything is on the same playing field. And I think that's where it gets more of a challenge. And Whitney, frankly, I think that's where projects like yours are very, very helpful, because it is more subtle, maybe more nuanced, but it doesn't mean that it's gone.
Absolutely. And I think that that's, I think that one of the things that I started questioning myself about are the projects that I was doing that focused on perhaps like horrible racial events like the James Byrd murder or something, is that it was allowed me to put the ideas that I was interested in outside myself. That, of course, I'm not someone who's going out and murdering black people, and I'm not a horrible racist, but when I start focusing on that stuff, that there's things outside me that need prescriptions, I'm not focusing on myself. And I think that, again, if I really care about changing the racial dynamic, then I need to focus on myself and my own community, not necessarily trying to attack things that are outside of me.
So since ACT Rochester is about using data to change how we solve our problems and the decisions that we make and the investments we make, the data shows that we have horrible inequities based on race. And it was the data that we looked at as the board of Rochester Area Community Foundation made the decision to fund the exhibit that came to the Rochester Museum and Science Center, Race, Are We So Different? The foundation doesn't fund exhibits. But when they saw the data of what was evident, not just in our city, which is one of the most segregated cities in the country, but in our whole region where there were major inequities, they said, we will fund an exhibit, but only if there is community awareness in advance of the exhibit and ongoing after the exhibit. And we have seen things like Facing Race, Embracing Equity, and Unite Rochester, and many other things catch momentum that hadn't been here in the past.
Yeah, I think that these are the kinds of conversations that we shouldn't be afraid to have. Mm-hmm. That I'm so thrilled that ACT Rochester and others are helping us see not only the data, but bringing these kind of exhibits and talking about it. Whitney Dow, for people who want to see the Whiteness Project, I described it as a multimedia documentary, but where can people find it?
Well, they can find it. It was produced in conjunction with PBS's POV, and I also just want to, you know, say that they were really, you know, they were wonderful partners and went out on a limb in this, because a lot of people turned away from this project when I brought it to them. But they can see it at www.whitenessproject.org. They can also go to the www.pov.org website, and there's some interviews with me and some other pieces to the puzzle. You can get at it through the POV website. But and you can also directly to the whitenessproject.org. If you just Google Whiteness Project, it'll take you right to it.
Yep. Let's get Tim in Pittsford. Tim, thanks for calling.
Hey, Evan, I agree with a lot of what the last caller said. I believe there is white privilege. I'm a white male. But from a different perspective, at my workplace, it's a large company. I'm on the hiring committee for our department. And there's a lot of people involved in hiring. Now, of course, we interview and we make recommendations to our HR department, strong recommendations. And three out of our last four applicants, we made our recommendations, and HR came back, and we hired three black men that we knew were not qualified for this. Well, I shouldn't say not qualified, but they had the education, they had a degree,
but the white applicant has a degree and years of experience, and we highly recommended them. And we can't say anything to HR, but we knew why these people were getting hired. And HR is really nice, and they let us call the applicants back and inform them that they didn't get the job, which is shirking their responsibility, but whatever. And that, you know, what do you say to these candidates? I mean, I've got two questions. What should I say? Because I call back and say we're going in a different direction. And they say, oh, geez, one of the guys said, I had everything that you asked for, and I can't, you know, what am I supposed to say? And what if one of the black applicants who got the job was to actually ask me, did I get this job because of my race? And if I said yes, I'm wondering what they would feel like. Would they be happy because of that, or would they, you know, I don't know what they would think.
You know, I'd love to answer that question.
Go ahead, Whitney.
I've thought about this a lot, and I think that is a really good question, and it's very, very, very complicated. And I'll tell you what I would say, because I've been in that experience, in that place. I would say, and I'll give you an example. I rely on grants from liberal organizations for a lot of my work, and I've been told very directly that it's harder to fund me because I'm a white male. And I might not get this grant because I'm a white male, when they're really trying to give underrepresented voices money. And I say, you know what? That's a drag for me that I didn't get that drag. Mm-hmm. But I have to put everything on the scale. That maybe I didn't get that grant, or this guy didn't get this job, but you can't only put one thing on the scale. All the other benefits I get from being a white person in the society, I have to take into account. And I sure as heck wouldn't trade those benefits and advantages for that job or for that grant. I wouldn't, and I have to take everything into account. It's very easy to put everything on, to trying to put only the negative things on the scale, but I think you have to look at the totality of the experience and your benefits, not just after the single thing. But I agree, it's a very, very complicated, difficult question, and it's something that a lot of people talk about when I talk about this, and a lot of people are grappling with.
Let me ask
Ann. What I don't understand is not everyone is in the same boat. I mean, it's not just because you're white doesn't mean you're privileged all the time. There are two of these candidates, two of the white candidates had been out of work for at least a year. One had been out for a year and a half. So I don't know if he, maybe he's probably privileged somewhere in life. I believe that, but he didn't get the job, and he's still out of work.
Would he trade his white skin for that job? I mean, I don't mean to be flippant, and I recognize that. And that's why I said at the top of the show that it's a very, very complicated, especially in places like Buffalo where I shop things, where people are really struggling. And I do not diminish their experience at all. I do not want to diminish their experience at all, or the people you're talking about. It is extremely, extremely complicated. And I have to be honest with you, because I'm not an advocate, I don't have answers. I have a lot of, like you, I have a lot of questions, and I grapple with the same things you grapple with. And one of the guys in the actual project talks about this thing. He's a tech guy, and he says, I work in a company with 50 people, and there's one black guy in my department. And I'm really confused as to what. Is it because nobody's qualified? Is it because of the hiring practices? And he's sort of grappling with the other side. Why is it in a city that is 38% black? There's only one guy in this big department. So these are extremely hard questions, and I'm glad that you're asking them. And I think you should sit down with HR and ask them to have an honest conversation with the company about it and explain themselves. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's you should absolutely do that.
Tim, can I Tim, hang in there, because I want to follow up, because Misty on Twitter is saying, I don't believe that people should be blamed for where they were born, what color they are now, etc. No one has a choice in those matters. I just do not appreciate the concept of the sins of the father continuing to pay for things that you do not have or that you have nothing to do with. You are responsible for your own actions. Now, Misty's comment implies that the racial inequity is all in the past, and that so-called affirmative action is a white penalty now, and that it is otherwise an equal playing field. Whereas what Tim is putting forward is that you've got a person who's been out of a work for a year and then doesn't get a job because they're white. And so I think those are different things. But Anne, let me ask you, when you hear these kinds of conversations, you heard Whitney's response. Mm-hmm. It is such a complex
It's very complicated. And, you know, I've been with ACT Rochester now 5 years, which was my first entry into the nonprofit arena. So prior to that, I was with three very large corporations and also with the state government. And in every case, they have different approaches to dealing with diversity, equity. The HR departments are very different in how they handle it, all trying to be sensitive. But it is a very difficult challenge, and it has morphed, you know, over the years of what we feel comfortable talking about and being open about. So, for instance, if Tim were to talk to his HR person and they were to have a discussion corporately, I don't know how comfortable that would be. Because it's one of those things people don't want to have a conversation about, and it's not consistent.
But we have to be able
to
talk.
You're mm-hmm. right. They didn't. We've gone to HR, mm-hmm. and they refuse to really get into it, mm-hmm. because when we go back to them and say, you know, what happened here? This was our recommendation. This person is can mm-hmm. come right in and do this job right away, and we didn't hire them. They're response is this: we wanted to go in a different direction, and we think this person is qualified and should get the job. That's it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what to do anymore. It's a very large company here in Rochester, and things aren't going to change, but it's very obvious which direction there's going. And it's hard for me as a liberal to, you know, I'd love to say there's always white privilege, and I think there is white privilege, but when I see it firsthand, when I see what happens in our workplace firsthand, you know, I don't know what to think anymore.
Tim, Tim, thanks for the call. And again, I think what this represents is one of the complexities that when you look at the whiteness project and you hear the man say, I think it's the white race that's being discriminated against. His experience may mirror what Tim is describing. And Whitney, I guess part of the point is, you know, even if we may disagree with him that the white race is the one that's persecuted in this country, mm-hmm. you want us to at least understand that context, and that he's probably similar to what Tim is describing.
Absolutely.
So 2 weeks ago, I was at the ROCO exhibit of Question Bridge, which
yes.
is just terrific, and I know you've had the team on your show.
Can you briefly describe it again, Anne, because it is great, and it's still up for another couple of weeks.
Yes.
I like Question Bridge a lot, yeah.
Yeah, Question Bridge is probably the kind of the opposite view of the Whiteness Project. It is African-American males of all different ages answering provocative questions. And yet the part that makes it an exhibit in a museum is because it has been edited in such a unique way. And these African-American men answer questions very authentically that are challenging, like, why don't you want to be successful? Or are you mad at your mother because you didn't have a father? And for us to be able to sit and hear those things is pretty eye-opening. But the point I wanted to make is that the black media representatives were at doing a panel. And one of the things that came out loud and clear was, if we don't have more people who are black and brown in the media, then sometimes some of the things that get shared don't reflect the way we view things. And so therefore there's this dichotomy of how do you deal with institutional racism if you don't bring more people into an institution that can bring diversity? So it just continues to be complex.
Well, and there was a Rochester media panel last week just exploring the fact mm-hmm. that newsrooms in this country are still dominated mm-hmm. by white people, largely white. And you know, again, I don't think that's a malicious mm-hmm. construct, but I think that it does have an impact. So let me get back to the phones. This is Kathy in Rochester. Kathy, go ahead.
Thank you for doing this show. It's excellent. As a white woman, I just want to say that what is often invisible to us is the way in which white affirmative action has been going on for so long, and nobody talked about it. So when it was happening, and I saw it firsthand, nobody went to that black applicant and said, oh, you know what, your application just didn't get considered because so-and-so's white nephew got the job or so-and-so's friend got the job, but that's what was going on. But that conversation never happened. It was white people hiring then, and it's white people hiring now, And now white people feel like, well, gee, what do I say to other white people? But nobody talked to people of color about what was happening. Mm-hmm. And it was happening all the time, and we're living with the outcome of that. I have to say, personally for me, my dad was hired at Kodak at a time when black people were not hired. It was a policy. They just weren't. And so I got to go to college because my father got that job. And I was the first one in my family to ever go to college. But I often think, what about all of the people in our community who are my age who didn't get to go to college because their parents were not hired? So I just think that we have to think about that. It isn't about, you know, oh, we're bearing the sins of our forefathers. It's more what is really going to make all of us a better society in the long run. And to have only some people benefiting, this doesn't make sense. It's not fair.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Let me start here in studio. Ann, what do you think?
I think that Kathy's right, that that sometimes just your situation that you're in provides you a privilege because of the what you're able to access. In fact, I would share that the Jiva production of Good People that is going on right now is a wonderful show that talks about, is it luck? You know, what is it that helps someone move from maybe an urban area into a suburban area or to get to college and be successful versus the ones that weren't?
Whitney?
Yeah, no, I agree with her as well, and I think that that's something that the reality of it is that, again, we've had so many advantages for so long that if you don't get that one thing, I don't feel like you can really complain. I think, you know, life's not fair, right? Hey, that's what I tell my kids, you know, all the time. And so you're not going to get some things. And, you know, but for a long time, the system was constructed so that black people didn't get those things, and it was codified in law and in institutional policy. So if there, let's say, again, it's, I think what's interesting is that, look, thank God that everybody's grappling with it now, and as we grapple with it and try to deal with it, we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to, like, handle it awkwardly, and it's going to make people uncomfortable, but, like, at least, like, the company that the last caller, you know, the two callers will call about, at least they're trying to grapple with it.
I also want to make clear that occasionally the host can misinterpret some comments online. Misty on Twitter writes back, says she did not mean to imply that everything is in the past and I shouldn't have taken it that way. And that's fair. Misty was the one saying that she doesn't believe people should be blamed for where they were born, what color they are. Mm-hmm. She doesn't appreciate the concept of the sins of the father, continuing to pay for things that you have nothing to do with. And I thought that indicated that the issues were sort of in the past, but we're still making people pay for them now. And Misty is saying that's not her point. So I appreciate that. And so I always want to make sure that sometimes on Twitter I can misinterpret. That's very easy for me to do.
140 characters.
That's exactly what you were saying earlier, right, Whitney? It's going to be difficult. This is Steve in Rochester. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, guys. I went to college in the 70s. I'm white. And I had grown up in the city till I was 12, moved out to the suburbs then, but grew up under some pretty horrific conditions with an alcoholic mother and basically a single father. And then I'd done lousy in high school for a lot of reasons. Afterwards, I worked as a janitor at Montgomery Wards in Waterville, and I worked with another black guy who was a janitor too. We were friends. And then, you know, I worked heavy construction, and those two experiences put the fear of God in me. I went back to Hudson Valley Community College at night, liberal arts, afraid I wouldn't do very good. Did great and matriculated into math science full-time and did great there. Then went into engineering, and then I graduated taking my class in Hudson Valley. And then I got a full scholarship to RPI. And then shortly before I was supposed to start, my advisor at RPI called me in and said because of EOP and quotas, my scholarship was going to get cut in half and that he would deny this if it was in public, but he felt that I deserved to know this, that you know, half of my scholarship was going to be given to a black kid with a lower GPA. Mm-hmm. And then my father and I scrambled to get federally guaranteed student loans, which thank God they were available, and we did. But, you know, that really made me seethe. And to this day, it makes me seethe. And then when I hear comments like, you know, it's very complicated, well, I would say it really isn't very complicated. I would say reverse discrimination is just as wrong as discrimination. And that's not solving a problem by, you know, putting the sins of the fathers on their sons, which is exactly what happened to me. So I would challenge that, you know, life is unfair and deal with it, with basically saying we need to make life fair. And we don't make life fair with reverse discrimination, quotas, and ELP.
How do you make it?
Sorry, Evan, go ahead.
No, that's Whitney jumping in, the filmmaker, the documentarian. Whitney, go ahead, and Steve, hang in there. Let's have a conversation about this. Go ahead, Whitney.
Steve, first of all, I appreciate you calling. I appreciate you sharing your story, and it sounds like you've had an amazing life and trajectory. I guess what we're talking about is, and this is where it's always very, very hard, is that the individual story doesn't. What I'm talking about is that if you look at the numbers, your story is very, very clear, but the numbers indisputably show that white people as a whole have undeniable advantages in the country. And I would ask you then, I agree you want to make it fair, but if the numbers say without question that we earn more money, live longer, have lower mortgage rates, have better health care, have higher disposable. How do we attack that? Because that's what we're getting at. I'm not saying, oh yeah, let's go and these are the prescriptions in order to do it. I don't know what the prescriptions are. And your story sounds horrific. And there's somebody in the project who I interviewed had a very, very similar story to yours, a guy named Omick. Who's a very conservative Republican and yet has also been involved in cases against the government for racial profiling. I don't know the answer. So I would ask you, well, how do you make it fair if it's clearly unfair now? Despite your experience, how do you deal with it?
I would say you make it fair by doing what is right at every step of the way, and that's not reverse discrimination. And, you know, I react very strongly to things that are wrong. My son goes to McQuaid. He plays football. Last weekend, they played Penfield. You know, some of the kids on the other team were calling three of the black kids on our team niggers. And I said, you know what? If I was the coach, I would say, just football, kill them. Take your anger out on the field and turn the game around. So I, you know, I'm all for justice. Justice is as core to me as my backbone. So to me, reverse discrimination is just as unjust as discrimination.
Now, Steve and Whitney, can I jump in here? Because what I think, Whitney, I'm hearing is, even if Steve and people acknowledge that on the whole, white people have an advantage, and on the whole, white people do have the advantage, the question is, do you even the playing field by looking for spots to give minorities the advantage, or do you even the playing field by seeking out where white people have the advantage and ruthlessly trying to roll that back and say that's, we're going to stamp that out. We cannot disadvantage minorities. We're going to seek that out, as opposed to saying, you know, so-called affirmative action, and we'll level the playing field that way. Is that a false question, Whitney, or is that a fair way to frame it?
I think it's a fair way to frame it, and I have to say again, and maybe this, you know, you guys will probably take it as a cop-out. I'm not here as an advocate.
I don't think it's a cop-out at all. I don't think it's a cop-out at all.
Answers. And really, all of this troubles me. Steve's stories trouble me, but when I look at the numbers and I see that the structural advantage that white people have, that troubles me. And that's what I'm trying to get at, because I don't know the answers. But I do know one thing, that if we don't bring white people into the conversation and let them speak honestly and without sort of these like preconceived rules of engagement around race and equality and diversity, we, the white people who hold all the power, have no incentive to work to change things.
Yeah, I think
that's really where I'm coming from.
I really enjoyed the way I appreciated the way you kind of framed it when you spoke to my colleague Beth Adams, Whitney, in that there's a similarity to climate change in that it's uncomfortable that it's happening. And nobody has a perfect answer for what to do about it, but there's a segment of the population that wants to then say, well, then therefore it's not happening, if the answers are difficult. The same thing with white privilege. It's happening, and there's not an easy answer for what to do next, but you know, it doesn't really do us any good to turn around and then say, well, therefore it's not happening. I think you're hearing from Tim and Steve, and you're hearing that there can be very reasonable disagreements about what to do about it, as long as we don't try to put our hands in our ears and say it's not happening. Is that fair to say, Whitney?
Absolutely. I think that's, you know, I think that analogy that I used with Beth is right. Is that, you know, just because you're cold doesn't mean that global warming doesn't exist. That's a complicated, it makes it very complicated to deal with, because your reality of your story is what you have to deal with every day. And I think that's what's interesting about this project for me, is that a lot of the stuff that I've read that sort of driven my thinking was very numbers driven. And so it's easy to sort of push yourself away, but when you hear stories like Steve, when you see the stories that are on the Whiteness Project, it brings to life the complication of the numbers and why it's so tough for us to grapple with it as a society.
Anne, what do you think?
Well, I've been reflecting on this for a bit, because it's a challenge to, as Whitney just said, there's the head part that's the numbers, and there's the heart part that's the how do we make things fair. And part of the challenge is just being able to find opportunities to have conversations on this topic, which it's much easier to ignore. Probably one of the most courageous organizations in our community in Rochester is the YWCA. You know, their mission is empowering women and eliminating racism, and they started the Stand Against Racism locally 4 years ago. And then they proceeded from that to just recently announcing a person-to-person, which is a biracial partnership program. 88 people are matched, a white person and a person of color, to be able to talk to each other and learn from each other about these kinds of differences and talk in a comfortable way. And then Gina's also taking the book Witnessing Whiteness and running 6 Saturday sessions for those of us who are white who want to understand our piece more. So some of it's our own learning, and then getting with other people and learning, and then looking at the fairness in everything that crosses our path.
Let me bring in another filmmaker. Carvin Eisen is a filmmaker who is on the line with us now. Hi, Carvin.
Hello, Evan and Anne. How are you?
Hi, Carvin.
And I'm really glad to hear this conversation. I came in kind of late, but I just wanted to weigh in if I could.
Please do.
Well, the question of white privilege always comes up. And I think one of the problems is the way the whole conversation is framed. It is always framed from a dominant cultural perspective. It is always framed from a white perspective. For example, we have to accept that the caller before, that what he said about the preparation and the appropriateness of the black candidates for the job he was talking about, we have to accept his point of view. I have sat on many committees, search committees, job search committees, and I know the exact opposite to be true, that the black candidate would be the most qualified for the position, but for some reason, a reason that we're going in a different direction, that person wasn't hired. And I would wager that that has happened many more times throughout the history of the country than the people that unfortunately who happen to be white and unfortunately gay caught up in the same reverse, what people are calling reverse, and feel the same way. But the opposite is much more true. Then I would say, finally, that the bigger question really is this. We're on this level. More and more young white people are beginning to recognize that they don't have privilege, that we hear this conversation about having privilege, but they don't see where they have privilege because they as well are being denied opportunity. They as well are being denied jobs and opportunities to go to school. So they don't see the issue because the issue now is becoming class. And we have to recognize that. It's race right now, but I guarantee you if Hillary Clinton runs for president, it will become a gender issue instead of a racial issue. And as long as we argue about gender, race, sexuality, we are never dealing with class, where the smallest percentage of people in this country own everything that there is. They own all the resources. They own all the rights to resources. You can't make a movie unless you have $1 million to get footage about Rochester because it's owned by some corporation in England, and et cetera, et cetera. So this is where the discussion needs to go. We have to start talking about class and the structural inequality that is built into this country, whether you're white or black.
Carvin, thanks for the call, and let me kick it over to Whitney. We got less than 90 seconds. Go ahead, Whitney.
Well, first I want to, like, you know, Carvin, I want to, like, send my condolences for you being a filmmaker. I know it's a tough road to walk. But no, you said a lot of things that I agree with, and I think you also, as a filmmaker, recognize that when someone shares your story, you can't challenge them on it. You have to hear it from them. And so we're talking about Steve. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, look, he brings up a huge, huge, huge complicated issue about class, although I personally feel a little bit that some white progressives use this conversation about class as a dodge to keep themselves out of the conversation when they say, okay, you know, it's about class, it's not about race. And as a white man living in America, I'd say, you know what, yes, that's true, but I can also tell you from my own experience, it's a lot about race.
And some final thoughts from you as well.
I just like to close with a quote that kind of takes into account all the different types of challenges that Carvin mentioned, and that is, our greatest strength as a human race is the ability to acknowledge our differences. Our greatest weakness is our failure to embrace them, because we have lots of differences. We've got to admit that and figure out how to move toward fairness and the right things in a collaborative way.
Ann Johnson from ACT Rochester, real briefly, where can people go to learn more about these different initiatives that have been happening? Where would you send them?
I'd send them to actrochester.org, go into the race button, and on that front page, it'll list all these initiatives.
For our callers who could not get through, it was a packed hour, and I apologize for that, but thank you for keeping the phone lines moving, the conversation going. Whitney Dow, you had all of us talking and thinking. I think it's a remarkably successful project. It's called The Whiteness Project. I've linked to it on my Twitter account, and it's easy to find. Thank you for taking the hour for us, Whitney.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great work that you've done here. And thanks to all of our listeners and callers, our engineer, Dave Campo. Thanks for being here. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections on member-supported public radio.